Good evening, everyone. Welcome to all of those who are tuning in to this really amazing seminar, webinar, organised by Eco Synagogue in conjunction with the Board of Deputies of British Jews. My name is Rabbi David Mason, and I'm one of the rabbis on the steering group of Eco Synagogue. Now, many of us are sensing something developing and improving about our relationship with nature. Scientists are noticing this. And a group recently in the journal Nature, Ecology and Evolution coined the term anthropause. Some talk about the Great Pause. We, of course, would rather have not had to live through the destructive effects of the present COVID pandemic. And we pray that governments across the world will be able to protect our populations from further outbreaks. But protecting life and protecting nature seem to be converging. Think of air travel. We cannot use this mode of transport in anywhere near the same numbers as a few months ago, and the restrictions will be with us for a while. What is working for the protection of humans is now also allowing some healing to happen in our atmosphere. Think of this seminar. We would either have driven or used public transport to reach whichever venue had been chosen. Apart from the fact that the reach of such a seminar is so much greater online, we're also saving what should amount to hundreds of miles of transport usage. Think of our synagogues. Yes, it may be hard for many, but our synagogues will not be putting out a kiddush for many months to come. Food consumption within our community buildings will have dropped drastically, as with any waste and use of plastics. Now, the scientists to which I referred are studying the Great Pause to see how humans and animals interact. We can think of this pause as a time when we align our values and commit to steps that make our communities and our homes more friendly to the environment. In Judaism, taking a pause is a time for reflection and tshuva. Tshuva is the Hebrew for return. And so a pause such as this present experience allows a return to a better state. It is up to us to grasp that state and ensure it is how we move forward. That is Eco Synagogue. We are passionate in order to help you, from whichever Jewish community you come, to play a communal part in protecting our climate and our world.
Thank you very much, David. And I'm Rabbi Tanya Saknovich from Nottingham Liberal Synagogue, and I'm a new member of Eco Synagogue Steering Group. One generation goes and one generation comes, but earth remains forever. Kohelet remarks philosophically in chapter 1, verse 4. Summarizing verses 13 to 17 from the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 11, allows me to say that the Torah brings our attention to the fact that our welfare depends on the land just as much as the welfare of the land depends on us. Even though most of us don't work on the land and we all purchase our food from shops, hopefully none of us think the food grows in shops. We are well aware of the fact that our well-being depends on the land. In fact, our well-being depends on produce from the land of many countries, both close and far away, as 80% of the UK's food supply is imported. Our relationship with the earth is often a dichotomy. We struggle to acknowledge our responsibility for the well-being of the land without realizing that in the long term, this means we are not taking care of our own well-being. This includes polluting the air, water, and land, the extinction of animals and fish, as well as animal cruelty. And we, humanity, are getting sicker too. We seem to focus more on how to treat disease rather than on how to prevent them. Many of us don't realize that it can be possible to live our lives without getting sick or always being tired. A few changes in lifestyle and others' diet can help us in body and as a result in mind too, to help us feel more energetic and joyful. Small steps can lead to big changes. A walk instead of a drive or some other exercise, and a diet without carcinogenic or fried foods, or even fasting sometimes, make a good start to one anyway's day. The subject of environment and healthy living is so huge that it requires the attention of all of us, not just a few. That is why it has been an enormous privilege for me to join the Eco Synagogue steering group with such distinguished rabbis in their noble mission to bring the attention of the whole Jewish community to the issues of the environment and to encourage us all to embrace sustainability and to create a symbiotic relationship with nature. It is time for us to accept responsibility not only for our own well-being, but for our planet as well. The lockdown has taught us a few lessons, and it is important to turn those positive encounters into transformative experiences. There are many ways in which we can help the planet and ourselves, and that's what tonight's evening, with an authoritative panel of members who we are delighted to host, is all about. Let's start making small steps which will lead to big changes together.
So I'd like to welcome the chair of this evening's panel, founder, of course, of Eco Synagogue, Rabbi Jonathan Wittenberg.
Thank you. And thank you, Rabbi Mason. Thank you, Rabbi Tanya Zakovich, for your focusing words to realign our values in a time of teshuvah, a time of transformative action. I'd like to welcome our panel from whom we're going to hear. Esben Larson is a fellow in food, forests, and water at the World Resources Institute. Tamara Finkelstein is permanent secretary at DEFRA, as well as being a former chair of my synagogue. And Josie Cohen is head of campaigns at Pesticides Action Network, UK. Edwin Shuka is vice president of the Board of Deputies of British Jews, with whom we're delighted as Eco Synagogue to be working and with whom we share this event. Our guests enable us to have an international, a national, and a regional and local perspective to go from the global to what you and I, each of us, can and should be doing at this time, which is a time both of crisis and of opportunity. And that's why we call the event How Green is Our Recovery. Now, going to begin with you, Esben Larson, and if I may give a slightly fuller introduction, that you have had a political career in the Kingdom of Denmark as deputy mayor, then a member of the Danish Parliament from 2011 to 18. You are a cabinet minister in Her Majesty the Queen's government, first with responsibility for higher education and research, and second, and very relevant to tonight, as Minister for Environment and Food. And you've also said that being a farmer's son, you're always deeply aware of our roots. At the World Resources Institute, your particular interest in food, forests, and water, it's very wide-ranging. So the first question I want to ask you is indeed wide-ranging. In an international perspective, what are the most important things to do with regard to the climate emergency we find ourselves in?
Thank you very much, and good afternoon and good evening here from Washington. I'm delighted to participate. And I would give a short answer to the first question, because it is really to limit temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius if we are to avoid increased climatic related catastrophes, such as fires, droughts, floods and hurricanes, but also rising seas, a loss of biodiversity, or pandemics as the current. And as always, if we don't act and invest in the common good as a turning point, it will really hit the most vulnerable groups, such as the informal workers, women and children, but also climate migrants from the global south. So limit temperature rise to 1.5 Celsius has an enormous importance for the future of our climate and our planet.
We in fact first met at the 5th anniversary of Laudato Si, in which the Pope links social justice and climate change. What are the most important actions you feel across the world need to be taken to try to achieve that limitation to 1.5C?
Well, one of the instruments that was developed with the Paris Climate Agreement back in 2015 was the National Determined Contributions, where each country that was a signature on the Paris Climate Agreement was supposed to develop plans to make the climate better with national solutions, thereby the NDCs. And these NDCs should be renewed every 5 years and be renewed with an even more ambitious goal than the original one. And this year, the national determined contributions are supposed to be renewed. And if we see that governments actually act on this, put in new policies, make new legislation around what companies and civil society are supposed to engage with when it comes together with governments to improve NDCs, we will take important steps in the right direction. And building on that, if governments also via their development aid will take initiatives like investment in renewable energy, solid infrastructure that can improve livelihoods, we can see a more just and we can see a better climatic situation also in our developing worlds, which is hugely important because we'll see alone in Africa an increase in citizens from 1.2 billion to 2 billion in 2050, so 800 more. And when we know that the hardest hit areas in the world will be sub-Saharan Africa when it comes to climate change, we really need via our development aid also to act.
I noticed that in that response, you twice used the word supposed to. To what extent do you feel governments are meeting their nationally determined contributions? And are there any means to encourage them to do so? As you said, they are renewed this fifth year.
Yeah, unfortunately, there's a lot of soft power in putting up goals and make international negotiation and agreements. But we definitely lack to see enough action. We have the ambition, but we don't have the action yet. And therefore, it's very important with an event like this that we see that the Jewish community pushes for an ambitious agenda on climate change. It is important with the signal from His Holiness the Pope on his COVID commission, where he is also giving addresses. But of course, also businesses and civil society that needs to require action from their governments. And that is through the political debate, through the scientific community. And since we are all citizens in a state, we need to raise our voice in the demand for change so we see that the government actually acts.
And what role in particular do you feel should religious leadership and religious community be able to play, not just locally in our synagogues and churches, but on the international and the wider political scene?
Yeah, overall, when we see at the moment that the big stimulus packages are being negotiated, we have seen the EU launching a stimulus package on 750 billion, where 25% are allocated for climate-friendly initiatives, but also the German government that has launched a package on 130 billion euro. Those are good examples on what we need to see more of. So the religious community really needs to appeal to leadership in the world to do fair and just and climate-friendly packages. But on the other hand, there's also a lot to do for religious communities. So when we look at the religious communities overall in the world, There's a lot of moral impetus to address for religious leaders, both in speeches inside the synagogue, the church, for the imam on his Friday address, but of course also externally to the leaders of the societies that the religious groups are part of. The leaders have voices that need to be heard. We need the religious communities to address freedom for the common good, and that aspect that is hugely important for securing especially the most vulnerable in societies, the strangers, the widows, and the orphans. And since most religions, if not all, have religious and sacred texts about the stewardship of our world and the resources we are entrusted, we see that all over Tanakh. We need that conversation evolving around the resources that the religious communities are also responsible for. And the religious communities globally are a major player. In Africa, in the developing countries, the religious communities runs 50% of all schools, a third of all hospitals. They have 18% of the total investment capital in the world. They feed billions of people, and religious communities own 8% of all habitable country, of all habitable land. That's the size of France, but they administrate 18% of 15%, sorry, of all the habitable surface in the world. So doing that with biodiversity for eye, doing that with increasing sustainable agriculture, forest, water consumption, that's a major influential player that we need to have activated even more.
Thank you, Espen. That's extremely helpful. And because we often feel powerless, that reference to the scope that religions have to contribute is extremely helpful and very encouraging to us. And that gives the broader international perspective into which I want to welcome you, Tamara. You've had many senior posts in the civil service, including exit delivery at DEFRA. Before that, safety program in the wake of Grenfell. And I know also you've worked very closely on children and social welfare. And now you're permanent secretary at DEFRA for a year in fact. And you're also within the Jewish community, senior sponsor of the Civil Service Jewish Network. And we've heard much that governments could be doing, and that word supposed to haunts us all. Can I though begin by asking you, how much is this a time of opportunity for what Rabbi Mason called teshuva, for this green recovery? Is the opportunity really there?
Well, thank you very much. And thank you very much for inviting me to be on this panel. It's such an important issue. And it's a mission that my government department's been tasked with to ensure that we leave the environment in a better state for the next generation. And I do think this is a very particular time to achieve that change. Because we find that actually people find it hard, despite David Attenborough's best efforts, to get their head around the impact of climate change and biodiversity loss. People see it as important, but not always urgent, and almost find it too big to contemplate. And oddly, this virus has actually helped people get their head around something which can be so global, that can be so difficult to see how it could you control it, to see something which kills, to see something which scientists have warned us about, and which we need to be prepared for. And suddenly people can see the impact of something of this order. And that has helped people to get their head around the impact of climate change and biodiversity loss. There is a choice people have. They can look at it and go, I now see the impact of that sort of this sort of activity. Or you could say, oh, it's too far in the distance. I'm too worried with the economic impact. So there is, people have a choice as to how they deal with it. But I'm very optimistic. And let me just tell you what makes me optimistic that this is the time for change. Before the last election, there wasn't very much on which there was consensus. But but actually all the political parties supported the 25-year environment plan and the environment bill that's coming to put it in place. They had different things, tweaks they would play on it, but there was some consensus around it of having a commitment to net zero by 2050, at least. There was consensus about making that commitment. There was consensus around us hosting what we would have hoped to have been doing this year, COP26, but we'll be doing next year and getting that next set of those of the goals for each country. So there is a certain degree of consensus that makes me optimistic, and the commentary on this crisis makes me more optimistic. So we have the commentary around rethinking right now around, well, what can we learn about business travel that we do it differently? What can we learn about the way that we use our green spaces and value our green spaces, the way in which we work and the way in which we travel? We are all thinking about those things. So that makes me optimistic that this is the time for it, but that's supposed to haunts me as well. And there is a job to do to make it actually happen.
Yeah, I was going to ask whether the optimism and the hope have got sufficient teeth, and whether they reach high enough in the political echelons in this country. And I know that sort of money speaks always, and where the economy goes is crucial to all of this. Do you see that there are real economic opportunities in the recovery for green industry? And do you feel, it's difficult for you to answer this one, are those opportunities falling on willing ears in this country?
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things I've been very nervous about during this pandemic is of praising too much the kind of the lack of economic activity, which admittedly means, you know, we have less cars on the street, some impact on our air quality and on less air travel. Because I think it would be very dangerous to suggest that the only way in which we're going to achieve our kind of net zero targets is by tanking the economy. And I don't believe that to be true. The impact has been immense, and the context in which we are going to be is a really huge impact on the economy. And to be honest, we haven't even really felt it yet, because the furloughing arrangements are almost a kind of anesthetic. So there is no question that the world in which this recovery needs to happen is one where people will be deeply concerned about the economy and about jobs. But I feel very strongly, and the government, the government that I serve, I see that across the cabinet and in the Prime Minister as well, a commitment to build that clean, green, resilient economy out of this. On Monday, we had a big event led by our Council for Sustainable Business, which is led by two business leaders and a committee, and they brought together businesses, 50 of the FTSE 100 businesses made their commitments around what they will do to drive towards net zero, often sooner than 2050 in their companies. And that driver from business, I think, helps to keep government also on track. And I actually think that when we look at what we will, I hope, achieved through COP26 and the climate conference, I think we will actually see business to some extent leading governments, because I think they look quite far ahead and they say that they see the real dangers and they recognise the changes that they have to make. So I actually think there is almost a pull on governments from business, and that gives me quite a lot of confidence. I mean, just obviously right now, the Prime Minister gave a speech yesterday. The Chancellor's giving a speech next week. I think we will hear elements around that green recovery commitment in that. Yesterday, a commitment to a green recovery challenge fund that can be bid for big conservation projects, which also hopefully will build new jobs and skills in the area of conservation and nature, so that you can see the beginnings of these things coming. So I think I think it goes hand in hand with economic recovery, a green recovery. That is the only choice.
I really appreciate hearing that, because one of the dangers, and Esben mentioned it as well, is this can feel all just too big to be able to do anything, and one can easily feel powerless and despair. So to sense that actually the economy might lead the way, and that there could or should be the political will there, is really encouraging. Would you say then, and I was talking to my 97-year-old mother yesterday, and she was looking at the street and the cars all back and say, so we're carrying on exactly the way we were before. But tomorrow, that's not what you see happening?
So I think that the curse in public policy making is the discount rate, which is the fact that we all heavily discount things that are future benefits. So there is a real problem around doing things soon enough and really recognising the change you have to make. And that's why, you know, we underinvest in our pensions. We don't put enough into preventing illness. We put it into acute care. And so that is always a risk. And I think, you know, climate change and biodiversity loss are absolutely in that category, that we fail to see the thing that is coming down the line and the action that we need to take now. So there is absolutely a risk of us not recognising and not taking this opportunity. But I think it's a tipping point. As I say, I think the impact of what people have seen in this kind of global pandemic and seeing a kind of global danger. I think the younger generation are hugely important in this. They do see it and they hold us to account for it. And they do not understand why we are not taking action sooner. And I think that is holding sway. I see that hold sway across government, actually with politicians and also with civil servants. I do think there's a consensus, and I think there's a kind of that business commitment. So there's definitely the risk of going backwards, but I think this is the tipping point moment.
And how can we as faith communities, and particularly, you know, I see around me what you say about young people, and I went to sort of see and support one of the school strikes. How can we sort of help put our weight on that tipping mechanism to make sure that to as faith communities and as leaders to do our best to make sure this happens? We've just got another minute, so that's a last question to you.
Okay, so I'll be brief. So, I mean, I think, you know, faith communities have, and faith leaders and community leaders are able to help individuals think through the personal actions and individual actions that we can take. I think that we are all often part of businesses or workplaces, and we can be encouraged to take action and encourage action by our businesses and questioning our leaders. I would say one thing that I think is really important, though, which is change is really hard. And I think faiths and religions know that. Change, it's not an easy thing. And I think if we pretend it's easy, we won't be successful. We have to get farmers, for example, to make a massive change to the way in which they farm for generation upon generation. And it's hard. And I think faith leaders are particularly well placed to help people think through sensitive change that doesn't dismiss heritage, that doesn't dismiss what's difficult, and helps us manage the difficult stuff. I think there's a real role for religious leaders on that.
That's a very moving comment to conclude on. Thank you, Tamara Finkelstein, because I think you're very aware that change is difficult as a faith leader, and helping us understand that and appreciate the challenges people face. And I remember on the day of one of the school strikes, you were actually talking to farmers and sort of at the front line of negotiating the complexity of change, and that needs to be appreciated too. And thank you for that very helpful insight, and I hope we'll all take that on board. You mentioned the personal and our and the local, and that takes us to you, Josie. You've been involved in a range of NGO organisations. It's included the League Against Cruel Sports, Save the Children UK, but for the last decade, it's been really social and environmental issues, and particularly those connected with large-scale agriculture. And as we leave the EU and negotiate different kinds of trade deal, I know that you've been extremely active there. And you joined, 3 years ago, you joined the Pesticide Action Network UK to head up the UK's campaigning policy and communications network. And we're really going to focus here on on the local, what is around us and what we can do. But we should begin perhaps by asking what role pesticides, environment, 1.5C, what role have pesticides played in the environmental movement, and what role should your campaigns be playing for us?
Yeah, thanks, Jonathan. Thanks so much for having me. I mean, in many ways, concerns over pesticides actually kicked off the modern environmental movement that we're all now part of, and the reason we're here tonight. So as many of you will know, there's a woman called Rachel Carson, who is an American marine biologist and conservationist. And she wrote a number of her books, but her most famous book is called Silent Spring, which was published in 1962 and is often credited with the beginning of modern environmentalism. And it described the environmental destruction that was taking place in America that was being driven by the widespread pesticide use, particularly looking at an insecticide that many of our older people on this call will remember called DDT. And it talked about how DDT had contaminated the America's water, soil, vegetation, killed birds and insects, and talked about how it had kind of disrupted the controls that nature has put in place to ensure that all species can live in harmony together and that one doesn't overwhelm another. And by helping to kickstart the environmental movement, Silent Spring changed the world. And I mean, it's said, many of you would have read it, and it's said to be as influential as Marx's Das Kapital or Darwin's Origin of Species. And it's a wonderful book that kind of combines science with a very poetic way of expressing itself. And it was 50 years ago, and Rachel Carson spoke about a silent spring, which was where spring returned after winter, but no birds sing, because all the insects and the birds have been killed. And that was more than 50 years ago. But since then, we have continued to drench our natural environment in chemicals. And I would say that our version of that silent spring is the windscreen. I don't know if people remember, but I remember from the 80s when I used to drive, my parents would drive me on long journeys, you'd have to get off and wipe the windscreen of insects. And you know, that hasn't happened for a good decade, if not more. In fact, if you speak to younger people, they don't even remember that. And that is our silent spring. And that's quite a depressing thought, but actually the solutions are there. It's not an unsolvable problem. Rachel Carson knew what the solutions are there. We know what the solutions are. Millions of other people do, and we really need to build the political will to do it. And in terms of that mission, we all have a really crucial role to play, and I'll come on to some more specific stuff that people can do later.
And that moment of change, is the COVID crisis then also an opportunity? Do you feel it has increased awareness of the urgency? And are you experiencing your campaign? Are you experiencing listening ears and the will to act and to end or change the use of pesticides so that the spring becomes full of song once again?
To some extent, it is a huge opportunity, as others have said, to rethink our relationship with nature and also to rethink our relationship with how we grow our food and how we relate to our food. As my wonderful MP, Caroline Lucas, the only Green MP in the UK, said recently, the sacrifices we need to make to solve the environmental crisis are nothing compared to the sacrifices we have made over the past weeks and months in response to the pandemic. I think it's really shown that you know, if the threat is serious enough, if we take it seriously enough, then we are willing to make sacrifices. You know, we need to move away from relying on industrial scale agriculture, which is just unsustainable in so many ways, including its reliance on chemicals. And COVID is a chance really to realign our investment and our focus into more sustainable local food systems, which are healthier for both people and planet. And as Tamara alluded to, some of this work was already in train because due to Brexit, obviously most of the UK's environmental and agricultural policy derived from the EU. So Brexit is an opportunity to rethink our agricultural and environmental policy, and the government is in, DEFRA is in the process of creating what is called the Environmental Land Management Scheme. And the idea is that will reward farmers, so provide farmers with financial subsidies for environmental outcomes, for delivering what are called public goods. And this is a real departure away from the EU previous approach, which was really to pay farmers on the basis of how big their land is, which then encouraged large-scale agriculture. So this could be a really positive move that was very much in train before COVID. And we're working on in quite a lot of detail. As Tamara said, it's not simple. It's a very complicated scheme. We need to make sure it supports farmers in the right way to make the change. It's not easy to be a farmer in the UK. If you want to be a millionaire, don't become a farmer. You know, they need the state support in terms of subsidies, also in terms of access to research. But actually, since COVID, we're starting to see some more worrying narratives arise, sort of pointing out that COVID has proved how vulnerable our food system is, and all the panic, particularly at the beginning of the crisis, where we had panic buying and empty food shelves. It's almost like proof that we can't make any genuine change. But I would actually argue the opposite. I think what COVID revealed to me is how vulnerable our current food system is. Mm. You know, in a way, we've outsourced responsibility for feeding the UK public to 12 or slightly more massive supermarkets who, you know, it can be argued have done a really, really good job to get on top of this crisis over the past few months. But they're private enterprises, you know. The right to food is enshrined in international law, and that's the state's job to feed people. And we need the state to carry on its work to really drive a more sustainable form of agriculture that can feed us all whilst working in harmony with nature.
Do you think awareness has gone up? Because I was very struck talking to a group of teenagers. One of them had apparently said, well, even if there's an environmental disaster, I can still go to Tesco's. And that's so not the case. But with COVID, I think people have become more aware that getting flour, making your own bread, small things have perhaps made us more thrifty and more conscious about where our food comes from. Do you think that's true? And part of them rolling it into one as a kind of last question to you, Josie, what can we do to help this need for change? Because it's in farming and we're not farmers, but do we have a role? Can we help?
Absolutely. There's so many things that normal people can do. And I would agree with you, Jonathan. I think like the younger generation does think more about these issues, where their food comes from, what the footprints of their food is, which is great to see. I mean, in terms of what people can do, you know, there's personal things you can do. You know, if you're lucky enough to have a garden or even window boxes on a balcony, don't use pesticides. Grow flowers which are good for insects and especially pollinators. You know, make your garden, your own land, whatever, even if it's just a tiny balcony, into a wildlife haven, and it will also be better for your health. You can act as a consumer, you know, where possible, buy organic. But again, organic is very often very expensive and not always available. So you can go and look. Our website actually has a list of, we call it the Dirty Dozen and the Clean 15, but which fruit and vegetables has the most pesticide residues. And you can start to see, for example, what's worth prioritizing organic and where, you know, for example, avocados have very, very low pesticide residues. So they wouldn't necessarily be your priority. You can also, as a consumer, use your buying power to choose which supermarket you shop at. So we have ranked supermarkets on the best and worst in terms of the actions they're taking to improve biodiversity. So you can campaign locally. So join a campaign to make your local council pesticide free. We've already had 80 councils across the UK go entirely pesticide free, which includes Hammersmith and Fulham in London, Brighton, Bristol, a number of others. So join that kind of local action and find out, is your office, is your school, are they using pesticides to manage your land? You know, I would presume New North London Synagogue, for example, doesn't use any herbicides, but find that out. And if they are, push for them to stop and create a more nature-friendly environment. And then finally, just to say, you can always advocate nationally. So, you know, we've got the agriculture and environment bills going through Parliament at the moment. We've got the trade talks with America, which I won't go into now, but are also a massive threat for UK pesticide standards. You know, tell your MP that you care about these issues, particularly if you live in a Conservative constituency who now have an 80-person majority. So we really need to get Conservatives on board with this agenda. You know, make your voice heard. We have really easy ways on our website. Take 2 minutes to email your MP and tell them you care about this issue.
Thank you, Josie. And I think we'll need to make sure that people through Eco Synagogue get access to exactly that information that you mentioned. And perhaps I'll mention that Rabbi Tanya, who opened, we heard at the opening of this event, has got 8 synagogues in the liberal movement having vegan Shabbats this weekend, which is a huge achievement. So thank you to all of you there, Esben on the international, and Tamara with DEFRA and what's happening in this country, and Josie, both the wider concern about pesticides, but also what we can do in a window box and in a garden, and certainly in the synagogue grounds. Thank you very much. In a moment, I'm going to invite Rabbi Mark Goldsmith, my colleague on the steering group, to join me, and we're going to reflect on Jewish teaching around what we've heard. But first of all, we're going to show a short film, a video from London Climate Action Week, of which this event is a part. A big, big thank you to all of you, and all strength with your work. Thank you. And in fact, London Climate Action Week has given us the date last year and this year for our Green Week and our Green Shabbat. Rabbi Mark Goldsmith, we've worked together on this project since its inception, and it's something you care about deeply. Just thoughts, texts, reflections that have gone through your mind as we listen to our guests?
Well, as Josie, as Tamara, as Ebsen spoke, each of them, they kind of brought up something from Jewish teaching for me. As Josie spoke about the effect of pesticides, there's a beautiful piece, one of my favorite Jewish environmental pieces from Kohelet Rabbah, which envisages God somehow leading Adam around the Garden of Eden and saying to him, look at my works, see how beautiful they are, how excellent. For your sake, I created them all. See to it that you do not spoil and destroy my world. For if you do, there'll be no one else to repair it. And we've heard about the possibilities of destruction that we can do. But also this very clear idea that it's not just about each individual one of us. We are very, very connected in this. We have a basic principle in Judaism of love your neighbor as yourself, which means love your neighbor's experience of the environment just as much as your own. And this whole coronavirus pandemic has shown us so directly what a connected world we are. Whilst we're also a local world, we're connected all the way through. And as we heard also from Josie, you know, if the threat is serious enough, the world will take action very quickly. Now, what are we going to do to change ourselves back in a way that doesn't continue to destroy the world, that is not destroying wantonly, Baal Tashchit, as we call it? I think one of the things I heard from Tamara was on the one hand that we're going to need to make change. On the other hand, change is difficult. And actually, I think one thing that Jews can contribute towards all of this from our own history is we've dealt with really big changes and managed it, often forced upon us, from expulsions to destructions of the temple and changes of the way that we worship to the horror of the Shoah and rebuilding communities. Perhaps one of the things that Jewish communities can show is how to make change work, how to make things be different, how to bring ourselves back in a different way. I also heard from Ebsen, he got that beautiful quote about the orphan and the widow, which is think about those who get affected by the environment more than anybody. You know, it's not us in London, it's that 1.2 to 2 billion people in poorer countries that there are going to be over the time. And I think as a Jew, you've got to think about that. You have to think about not just yourself, but think about those who are disadvantaged in your society. I also love the fact that Tamara spoke about L'dor V'dor from generation to generation. She said it's really difficult to, as she called it, discount the future, as in invest in the future for the benefits for the future. But for this time, we really can. And that's what we always have to do in environmental change, because you're not going to see the changes so quickly, although it was so disturbing when Josie talked about the flies on the windscreen. And she's right. I remember that as a child, but it doesn't happen anywhere near as much. There's so many. Yeah. That's where I'd like to kind of start.
Yeah. In a moment, we're going to bring everybody together, but I think I'm going to put a question to you and then to the panel. Rabbi David Mason, at the beginning, in fact, I'll just hold. Let's bring everybody in together, and I'll put this to all of us and see what we think of it, if we all come back together. Thank you. So, you know, you spoke, Rabbi Mark, about the connectedness of the world and humanity and nature. Rabbi David at the beginning talked about that anthropausal moment, the coining of that phrase. And something which has been talked about very much among environmentalists is this very anthropocentric view of the world that we have, mm-hmm. that the human being is superior, that our agenda has been control. And we don't really talk about that in, you know, we talk about that often in a colonialist sort of discourse, but how much do we talk about in relation to nature? And is there a kind of both a spiritual and an economic change, both of them needed to change our fundamental attitude towards the world around us? That's a question I kind of want to put out there. It's a little bit of time for us to talk together, and then we'll see what questions have been directed our way by our listeners. Is that something, Esben, would you be okay to pick that up as a starting point?
Yeah, thank you. I think it was a great reflection, and also thank you very much to both the other contributors into this conversation. So the deployment of wealth in the world is, of course, an important tool in regards to make it better for the orphans, the strangers, and the widows. And we, from typically Western countries, we need, of course, to look into what is it our responsibility is. A very concrete thing. Today, 1/3 of all food in the world is lost. In the UK, RAP has been doing a lot, and the UK is leading on fighting food loss and food waste globally. But try to imagine what it means for our resources that 1/3 of all our food is wasted when we at the same time have millions and millions of people that can't get the food they need. So in that regard, we have a moral, we have a nature responsibility to use our resources better, but we also have a financial responsibility, since the loss of food is around $940 billion annually in cost. So this is just one concrete example where we can do something in our home, where we can do something with our shopping basket, we can do something politically, but we can really much do something morally and religiously in the world.
That question of sort of change of inner attitude, is that, Tamara, what you had in mind when you talked about the difficulty of change? Were you thinking of the, as it were, the spirit, the re-evaluation of our approach to the world alongside a change in agricultural economic policies and business?
Yeah, I mean, I think this requires of us a change in lots of the ways in which we have, we sort of our reflexes to live and the way in which the economy is developed, and changing that just is a challenge, and it's just worth accepting that it is, and therefore, and that makes it easier to tackle if you accept that it is big change, and that there are. Yeah, that people will lose out, and you have to think about, or how do you deal with that? I think it's a really, our relationship with nature is a really important part of that, and I think it's the thing that I've learned most by coming to DEFRA, and the importance of actually not just focusing on net zero and on emissions, but also on the biodiversity loss that the windscreen example tells us about, and also about the interconnectedness that actually, by doing the right things, by looking at nature-based solutions, you know, for example, we're in charge of flooding, and you can build big bits of infrastructure, and sometimes you need to do it, and you do it with cement and so on, and you use, you know, the emissions from just the work you do to create that. That's one way, but there are nature-based ways to do it. There are ways in which you can use trees and a whole range of ways of how you treat your soil that will help you prevent flooding. And we need to be rethinking in that way and thinking about how does nature in itself help to sort of, support us on the other environmental objectives.
You used one of my favorite words just then, Tamara, the word trees. And this gives me a chance also to mention jtree.global. That's jtree.global, which is the Jewish community's contribution to the massive need to reforest. And perhaps it doesn't strike us, but Britain is one of the least forested countries in Europe and urgently needs to increase its tree cover. Alongside, the same applies actually to Ireland. Many people have sent me pictures of birds, of plants, of insects that they've noticed during COVID with the slowdown that they hadn't noticed before. And an early survey in April suggested that only 9% wanted to go back to how things were before. And the biggest change was a revision of our inner attitude to nature. There's also been a lot of reflection on the healing properties of time in nature. Josie, you and I share the love of dogs and animals. Do you see your generation as more aware of that? Is that something that's growing, and the generations younger than us? A reorientation?
I certainly do see that in generations younger. Yeah, I'm not so sure in my generation, but I think just to go back to your previous question, I think we really do need to change attitudes. And I think one of the core ones we need to change is this idea that infinite growth is possible on a finite planet. I mean, I'm not quite sure where that came from, but, measuring our success in GDP, basing our whole kind of measure of how well our country is doing around essentially economics is really something that we can move away from. And I thought it's really interesting what Tamara said, because there's this attitude particularly towards the word innovation that I also think really needs to change. And, innovation is seen as technology and chemicals and robotics, but there are all these nature-based solutions, as Tamara said, that used to be the way of doing things, like before pesticides came around in the 1950s, for example. And in a lot of ways, I think we need to go back to before that time and see nature-based solutions as innovative in and of themselves.
You used a key word there, which we haven't actually focused on yet, but I think we've got a little bit more time. You used the word growth, an infinite growth. It's something Naomi Klein has very much criticized, as an unbridled, not capitalism, but unbridled capitalism. Growth has never been particularly a Jewish value. Sharing so that the poor have, and wealth for the good of society is worthwhile, but growth has not been, as it were, a central value. Appreciation has. Is there something there very fundamental that needs to change in our attitude to what success in life looks like? Esben, you're smiling at this. Have you got some thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think this is, of course, a personal opinion around these aspects. I think that COVID has shown us that it is actually healthy not to engage all the time, and that being a spiritual human being, where you enjoy nature, where you enjoy time with your family or a few friends, that you can see that life has enormous values in engaging on a lower scale than normally, where we are so busy with meetings and children needing to go to daycare or things in our spare time. But understanding that being able to be with yourself is also a very healthy thing. And what better place to do that than in nature, or to study the nature-based solutions to see how that can improve our livelihoods in many ways. And that is really where the moral and ethic and religious voice have a role to play here.
Tamara, do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think just a reflection of taking some care to recognize that it is not always equal. The people who access our green spaces, when we look at that, it is too narrow a section of our of our society, and we have to do a lot more to spread that to help a much wider section of our of society to engage with nature. We find that there are communities living right next to the Peak District who have never been to the Peak District National Park, and there is a huge a job of work to do to change that, because we do need to change how people feel and how their relationship with nature, and it is not equal at the moment. So there is a big job of work to do on that.
Yeah. Josie, you want to come in on that?
Yeah, just to say, I think that's so important that it's about environmental justice. It's not just about environmentalism. You know, things like, you know, a congestion charge, or when they say don't worry about chlorinated chicken, it will have a label on it. But poorer people still won't be able to afford to buy their way out of that environmental problem. So I think it's really important. And this is in a way some of where the diversity and inclusion stuff kind of interacts with the environmental agenda. And, you know, we all know that the environmental movement is kind of notoriously white. And that is really something that we all need to work on and ensure that these environmental benefits are communities are able to access them equally.
Yeah, I think at the beginning of the COVID crisis, there was a sense that this is an equalizer, but it's come more clear that it's not an equalizer, and that for people, I've been lucky enough to have a garden, and that is so radically a different experience from being in a flat with young children and having no such access. We've a little bit of time from the questions that we've had. There was one right at the beginning, which and I'd like actually to bring Rabbi Mark back in, if I may, if that's possible. We were asked right at the beginning if we're eco synagogue here, if all our communities kept the Sabbath, how much greener would we be? And if particularly the non-Orthodox, but I actually think it applies to the Orthodox, not everybody in Orthodox synagogues keep the Sabbath either. How much is there to learn from that?
I think there's something great to learn about that idea that one of the things we do with a day of rest is not to consume excessively and try to find ways to reduce the way that we consume, perhaps by using Shabbat as a time when we don't do the things that we do on the rest of the week. I know some of the choices that Jews will make, or Reform Jews, may be different to choices that Jews might make who are Orthodox Jews. But yeah, I think we can all choose to find time when we do not consume as much as we do in the working week. And that seems like a really healthy and right thing to do, and a great learning of Menucha for us.
And Tanya, your thoughts on that? You've been so successful in a short time in bringing communities on side with this agenda. What are your thoughts? We can't actually hear you, I think. We can't hear you, Tanya.
Thank Great. You, Jonathan. I just wanted to say that I'm so excited because we've got 8 communities tomorrow coming together to celebrate Green Shabbat. And I agree with Rabbi Mark, and I think it's important to have time for all of us. And Shabbat is a really good time to stop and make that space, that holy space in our lives, a green space as well for all Jews to the nations.
So a very big thank you to everybody. We're coming towards the end of our time. And just before I hand over to Edwin Shuker, who's the Vice President of the Board of Deputies, I want to mention that we are creating an exciting program with Eco Synagogue, and we're putting it together. And we had the good news just today that Alok Sharma, who's the Business Secretary, as well as President of COP26, conference, has confirmed that he will do an event with Eco Synagogue, we hope sometime towards the end of the summer. So that's an exciting way of taking it forward, and also putting to someone with real influence and power the kind of concerns that we've expressed, that all of you have expressed here. I'm going to invite Edwin to conclude our evening, and also I want to say how good it is to be in partnership between Eco Synagogue and our steering group of rabbis and the Board of Deputies, to be truly cross-communal and to play our part as the Jewish community in what the different religions have to bring to bear on this most important issue. Edwin.
Thank you, Rabbi. It's my privilege to give thanks at the end of this fascinating panel discussion. I want to thank Esben, Tamara, and Josie for sharing your experience, your knowledge, with practical advice to those of us who are listening with intent. I want to thank Rabbi Tanya, Rabbi Mark, Rabbi David Mason for being one of the pioneers, and of course, the inspiration behind this project, Rabbi Wittenberg. I want to thank behind the scene, Andrea Bast and Leo for making this a technical success. Eco Synagogue was one of the first projects I was involved in after my election. And I honestly, as soon as I heard the content, I said, this is it. If it's only for this, it's worthwhile being involved with the community and the Board of Deputies. The Board of Deputies is genuinely excited to be partners with Eco Synagogue to support this initiative. We would like every synagogue, regardless, across the board, regionals, all denominations, to take it on, to embrace a more sustainable way of operating and to ensure that our relationship with the environment is a focal point of not just our personal, but also our communal lives. Thank you all for educating us. Thank you for joining us, all the viewers, and good night to you, and thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Edwin.